Good morning, and welcome to this month's edition of Alternative Currents. This morning, our guest, Robert Romanishin, has written a bit of his biography, which I'm going to read to you as an intro from his website. I am a former psychotherapist who entered clinical psychology through the door of philosophy, and who over the last 30 years, following the hints of dreams and symptoms, has tried and failed to find the exit through the door of poetry. In this respect, I regard myself as a failed poet who recognizes now that psychology has been a necessary and very good cover story, which, in accordance with my name, Romanishin, means son of a gypsy, has allowed me to wander among disciplines. Robert Romanishin is a core faculty member at Pacifica Graduate Institute and has been since 1991. He earned his PhD in 1970, where in clinical psychology, studied phenomenology, philosophy, and depth psychology. He has published a few poems, 5 books, chapters in dozens of edited volumes, and numerous articles in psychological, philosophical, and literary journals. He's also written a television script on the history of the soul and Western consciousness, which he says no one seems interested in producing. I have a hard time believing that, given the nature of this work. Today, I have invited him on the show to talk about his book, or the material that he sets forth in the book, Technology as Symptom and Dream. I recommend this book highly, and if you are interested in his work, extensive and knocks my socks off. You can read all this and more on his website, www.online.pacifica.edu/Romanishin, and I'll spell that for you, Romanishin. And as always, you're welcome to email me via my website, bellajohnson.com, for any information about this or other programs. Welcome, Robert.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning for you and afternoon for me.
That's right. Yeah.
Can we start
on
up?
The West Coast.
Yes, you are. Sorry. Can we start up by having you define soul? Because there are so many different ways of speaking to soul in psychology today. Yeah.
Well, I think over the years, for me, coming out of the traditions both of phenomenology and depth psychology, it has expanded. So the focal point for me is that to live, love, and work with soul and mind is a work of anamnesis or unforgetting. And so soul for me is about against forgetting. It's the capacity to return for the sake of regarding, remembering, and reanimating things that we leave behind, marginalize, forget, repress, both in our individual and our cultural collective lives. And the other thing for me over the years that has to do with soul is that there seems to be an intimate connection and maybe a necessary connection if you look at the myths, like the Eros Psyche tale, of a connection between soul and love and loss and grief, and the connection of soul with the underworld, with death. And finally, particularly coming out of the work on technology, soul for me is the capacity to, for double vision, what Blake, the poet Blake, meant when he said, may God us keep from single vision and Newton's sleep. The capacity then to see the dreams and our reasons, the complexes and our concepts, the myths and our meanings, the symptoms and our symbols, the originating metaphoric vision in our traditions, the fantasies in our facts, the images in our events. All of that I see as a work of kind of shifting consciousness from bloody literal-mindedness to a place where you know you're always in a perspective, a myth, a dream, a fantasy, even if you don't know what that is. A recognition then that we are always co-constituting the world from the place where we are, historically, culturally, psychologically at the moment.
One thing I love about your book, Technology as Symptom and Dream, is that you describe kind of how we got here via technology and how that came about through the advent of linear perspective and the anatomical perspective. I'd love it if you'd really talk about that as much as you feel like you want to.
Okay. Well, first, if I could begin with a little story about how this book, Technology, A Symptom and Dream, came about, because I think it indicates, at least for me and hopefully for other people, that like with love in our life, the work that we do chooses us as much as we might think we choose it. And this work was actually born on an innocent stroll in a museum when my younger son, Andrew, who was about 10 at the time, was staring at a painting that dated from the Middle Ages. And I went up to him and I asked him why he was so caught by this image. He said to me with a kind of impertinence that only youth can have, that this guy didn't know how to paint. And I said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, look at the bodies in this painting. He said, they look like cartoon characters. And a light went on. And it took me 6 years of my life to kind of understand what that remark meant, because the painting predated linear perspective. So I began reading. I certainly hadn't thought about linear perspective. And I discovered that as an artistic invention in the 15th century, it has quickly become a cultural convention, a habit of mind, which has given rise to all of the wonders and the dangers of our technological world. I read Alberti's text on painting, which coded the experiment that Brunelleschi had done in the 15th century in Florence. And essentially what linear perspective is a way of distancing ourselves as if we are looking at the world through a window. It was an attempt artistically to portray three-dimensional depth on a two-dimensional plane. And it required two technical innovations, the establishment of a vanishing point and a distant point. I was interested in how these technical innovations, what they meant for the emotional life of individuals. What does it mean to look at a world as if we are on one side of a window and the world that we see is on another side of a window? So I began to write about how linear perspective establishes an invitation to keep our eye upon the world. And it's in this space that we began to look at the world as a spectacle for our observation, our measurement, our use. And we become a spectator then on this side of the world. And what disappears then, you know, if the world is simply and primarily what is an object of vision, then all the qualities of the world that go with lingering through and with our bodies, all of the other senses, taste, hearing, touch, we begin to lose touch with them. And so linear perspective vision then became for me, and the way I tried to describe it in the book, is also an invitation to take leave of our senses, which is a form of madness in a way, because it's an attempt to turn one of the possibilities of our engagement with the world, vision, into a method, into an epistemology. And it means leaving the body behind, because it becomes an impediment to the spectator who, keeping an eye upon the world, has an infinite vision that knows no bounds. And so the body, too, must be transformed. And what I found is that linear perspective gives us the codes by which we live today in a culturally unconscious fashion, as spectators in a world that has become a spectacle for our observation and use, and in which the body has become a specimen. So one of the other things that I discovered is that at the same time that linear perspective is coming into being, anatomy changes, and we go from anatomical text on the far side of linear perspective, in which the body is still treated as a dead body, to the anatomical gaze, in which the body is initially and then fast becomes an object of vision, a thing, a corpse. And there's a vast difference then between the body as a dead body and the body as a corpse. And these are the codes by which we live today. So that's a kind of summary. I can go into more detail if you wish.
And we will, I would imagine. Yes, you mentioned how in our culture we make life the opposite of death. And when you talked about the dead body as opposed to the corpse, yes, you know, how we've removed the smell of death, how we've removed all the olfactory senses around that, how we've cleansed our palate, you know, so to speak, of those kinds of unsavory things.
Mm-hmm.
So how has this led to a sense of the self as somehow a separate entity from all that is, from this cycle of life and death?
Well, once the self, again, in the detail that I went into in the text, where the self becomes a spectator, and all you have to do is look at all the instruments of technology from the 15th century to our world today that have increasingly allowed us to have a distance and a separation from the material world and even from our own bodies, from the invention of the telescope, not with Galileo, but he was one of the first to use it, to the internet. We have a vision of ourselves. We have created ourselves in the image of someone who is a mind that is disincarnate, a mind that can take leave of the flesh. And once we do that, one of the things that I try to write about is that the origins of technology, the modern origins of technology in the 15th century, because I'm a depth psychologist, I was looking at what are the dreams that are behind these reasons. What is the soul saying in this creation of ourselves as a spectator? It becomes very clear that two of the dreams here that are interconnected is the dream of abandoning the body and departing the earth. And both of those dreams have to do with distancing ourselves from matter. And once we do that, you can begin to see then that behind both of these dreams in technology is the age-old specter of death, the eternal presence of death in human life. And so technology becomes then a way of conquering death, or at least taking an attitude towards death, in which we make death the opposite of life. But death then becomes the enemy. And all of our technologies today are predicated, at least our medical technologies, are predicated on prolonging life in the face of death, conquering death, seeing death as the opponent. And what we forget in that process is that death belongs to life. We owe life a death. Not only do we owe life a death, but that even puts it too far in the future. What we forget is that we have to take dying into our very living. So it's not death as the opposite of life. It's birth and death. And what belongs in between is life. Life is what happens between coming into this life and exiting this life. And so we need to have, as is happening, near-death experience, etc. I think this culture of distance is beginning to break down in many ways. But we're beginning to understand that the task of being a fully loving human being is to learn to love in the face of loss. I like to quote the poet Rilke here. It's not a direct quote, but the task is to love the rose that in its blooming is already beginning to fade. So I think we run away from death, and I think what we run away from, I mean, depth psychology has taught us, comes back to haunt us as a symptom, and we can see the culture of violence and death all around us today because we deny it.
Right. It's nice to see almost like a resurgence of the honoring of that grief and death. I think in my own observations as a kind of an alternative practitioner, I've seen back in the 80s kind of you wrote this book shortly after. I think it was in 92, wasn't it?
89.
Okay. There was this big kind of New Age movement toward what they called star beings or aliens or, you know, all of this interest in otherworldly kind of things. And then moving from that toward more recently, it seems there's a lot more Buddhist thought out there, which kind of, I think, gives people who are looking, who are spiritual seekers, more of a ground in reality, more of a ground in the world. And so we're back to the basics, the grief, death, anger, fear, you know, the kind of givens of life. And it's, for me, it's been a good thing to see.
Well, that's a nice phrase, I think. I mean, one of the things that the spectator mind, what I call the mind of reason, eclipsing the soul of the world, is that it forgets that there are givens in life. Yes.
Again, I'd like to remind listeners, we are speaking today with Robert Romanishin, author of Technology as Symptom and Dream, another wonderful book that he's written, Ways of the Heart, a collection of essays. I highly recommend you go onto his website and check out what he's done. You can get to that website, www.online.pacifica.edu/Romanishin, R-O-M-A-N-Y-S-H-Y-N. You can also go to Amazon or your local bookstore and request these materials. So, to continue, when I'm looking at this information about Francis Crick, and with James Watson, of course, decoded the structure of DNA.
Right.
And you say he speculates in his recent book, Life Itself. I would imagine recent meant back in the 80s.
That's right.
Yeah, so the stuff of DNA could only originally have come from the stars. And if that's so on. Yeah, can you get into that a little bit? Because I've got something to ask you about that.
Yeah. The book for me was also, was not only difficult to write, but it was fun because I came across all of these fantastic pieces of information, one of which was Francis Crick's book, Life Itself. And in that book, he says that life on this planet could only have been seeded from outer space. And he builds his case for that. It's an old 19th century idea that he resurrects. I don't recall it right now what the idea was.
It is one of those. Yeah, sorry. The telephone once again is getting to us because we can't look eye to eye and decide when to jump into the conversation. You mentioned Terence McKenna. I mentioned Terence McKenna,
right,
and want to mention him to you. But you mentioned Timothy Leary and his take on this, I do believe. I can't find it right away here. This doesn't...
I remember Leary's, I think it was page 27 in the text.
Okay.
No, it's not there, but in any case, I do remember what Leary was about in his work in the 60s and 70s and its connection with the connection that I was trying to speculate about with Crick. If I could just get back to the Crick thing for a minute,
sure,
one of the interesting things about his book was that he sees technology, especially for spaceflight, as DNA's way of redesigning the body to go back into space in search of its original home in the stars. That to me, as a depth psychologist, is a wonderful fantasy, but that has to be looked at also for what it's forgetting about our ties to the Earth. I mean, I do think that we are destined, that technology in a certain sense is a vocation, and we respond to the Earth's call to more fully realize itself through the cultural symbols that we create, one of which, of course, is technology. But at the same time, if we forget that it is a vocation and we are in partnership with the Earth and that we continue the ongoing act of creation and we take ourselves to be the masters of creation, to become almost like gods, then it enters into abandoning the Earth. And that's the dark side, I think, of Crick's fantasy. And that's the same thing that Leary was talking about in his wonderful wildly funny book, Neuropolitics, that he published, I think, in the late 60s.
I did find the quote. He says, "We are all neurogenic robots programmed to leave the earth and destined by our genes to shed the skeletal husk of the human body." Some of those words are yours. And I thought it interesting because Leary, of course, as many or probably all know, did a lot of LSD, which was a mind-expanding kind of drug. On the other hand, Terence McKenna, Rupert Sheldrake, and some of those fellows were, at the same time, eating mushrooms, which are substances that represent the old earth kind of energy. And so you've got Leary talking about, you know, going out of the body, and you have McKenna and Sheldrake talking about how their visions took them to a place where they saw the alien beings as actually Davic beings from the center of the earth. I don't know if you're familiar with this, but I found it pretty interesting to take a look at the two opposite ends of the pole there.
I am a little bit familiar with McKenna's work. I've met Rupert Sheldrake. I like both of their work immensely, but it is an interesting contrast because the Leary one is a kind of manufactured vision through better living through chemistry, we used to say.
Right.
And it's an appeal to, as he says, escape the gravity well, this 40-mile gravity well that we have. Whereas the other one that you cite, McKenna and other people who were using the natural substances of the earth, they see visions. I mean, it reminds me of Blake. I mean, the other thing that has led me, I mean, from technology, I have really been led into trying to understand what would be an ethical and therapeutic way of knowing the world and living in it. And I think we have to recover a kind of new psychology of matter that takes us beyond the materialism that we're caught in, where nature is dead, inanimate, without soul, and back to a poetic realism. You know, when Blake says in Songs of Innocence, to see a heaven in a wild flower and a universe in a grain of sand, to hold infinity in the palm of your hand and eternity in an hour, you know, that's not a fact. It's not a fact that there's a heaven and a wild flower. It's not even a good idea for ordering the world in terms of a rational system. But it's phenomenologically true. And the poet's vision, I think, is something that we have to learn to recover, because the poet's vision has an aesthetics to it, not an aesthetics in the sense of beauty, but it opens up our feeling connection with the world, which when we're spectators behind the window, we have lost.
Yeah, definitely. You mentioned gravity, and I love your comparison to gravity and the fall set forth in Genesis, the fall of humankind. Could you explain this a little bit to the listeners?
Yeah, can I tell you a funny story first?
Absolutely, I wish you would.
When this book came out in 1989, they're now going to do a fifth printing on it, so it's had staying power, which in a way has delighted me and surprised me, because I didn't think it, you know, it would appeal to that many people, but apparently it has.
I just got to break in and tell you, I have more margin notes in the first chapter of your book than I have in most entire books. It is so amazing. I'm so happy that you're on this program talking to people, because it's really important for me as a host to get this information where people can access it, because of that fact that it seems like it's timeless. But go ahead about with your funny story.
Yeah, well, it was shortly after the book was released that I was invited to a small college in Texas, Austin, Incarnate Word College, by a friend and colleague of mine to speak at some mind science thing. That wasn't the name of it, but it was a series of lectures sponsored by this wonderful lady in Austin, Amy Freeman Lee, who just died last year, a real benefactor and patroness of the arts. And she was in the audience, and I had my slides and all my technological equipment, and I was going to start off by this point about how technology is a way of getting our revenge for being kicked out of paradise. It's a reverse of the fall. It's like storming the heavens to get our revenge and to become like the gods. And none of the equipment would work. The slide machine broke down, and And all the technology that I was relying on to give my talk about technology just wasn't there. It wasn't available. It was broken. And so I had to ad lib for 40 minutes, and I just started telling stories from the text. And Amy Freeman Lee, then, what happened after that is that she had already endowed a chair in the humanities and fine arts at Incarnate Word College, and so I guess my jokes were funny enough and my stories were good enough that she invited me then to be the first holder of that chair. So good things come out of technology, which also for me, I don't want to lose this point in this conversation, that we can't disinvent technology. Forevermore, we're going to have to live with the awesome power that it has given us. I was impressed in the 80s, I think it was, by this book by Jonathan Schell, The Fate of the Earth, as I was working on my own text here. And because we can't disinvent it, can't forget it, we're going to have to come to terms with what this power gives us and begin to live with it in a soulful fashion. And in that respect, maybe technology can be, as part of our vocation to the earth, a homecoming. So I close the book with the image of the earth from space. In the lines of the poet Eliot, "We shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all of our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time." And if you look at the earth from space, there's two possibilities. Is it our final farewell, or is it the beginning of a journey of homecoming and more fully realizing that our humanity is inseparably bound with our material condition and our bodies, and our bodies' erotic love affair with the earth?
Well, I thought of, while reading this book, I thought of several things. One of the things that I thought about was how things have to serve us because we're here, you know, how it must eventually come to a place where it's going to be a benefit somehow. So I'm going to quote a little bit from the book here. "In the space opened up by linear perspective vision, humanity is on the way to replacing God in the center of things. When human vision starts to become the measure of the world's horizon, the deity is on the way out. When we ourselves become a god, a deity is no longer needed. God loses his place in the 15th century, et cetera, et cetera." And I'm wondering if part of how this is serving is by getting us, moving us from an external view of God to perhaps seeing the God within through the vehicle of the ego, which eventually needs to be shed or transcended, not shed, because I don't think we can do that, but prove me wrong. But I'm just curious as to what you think about that.
Well, I think that's a really excellent question. That's one of the other, I think, long-term implications that has sustained my work since the publication of the technology book, and that is, can human beings live without some sense of otherness that is sacred and divine? And I think we're fast seeing that we cannot do that, that we measure ourselves not by our own vision, because we're too small and too fragile and frankly too arrogant to be the measure of the world and of creation. So we need and are hungry for a sense of the sacred and a sense of the divine. But what technology, I think, allows us, insofar as we initially believe ourselves to be the lords and masters of creation, we become as gods. If you look at that symptomatically, and a symptom for me is always a tension between remembering something that is too vital to forget while forgetting something that is too painful to remember. So if we take that symptomatic approach, then something is happening with technology that is asking us to look at how our image of God as a patriarchal sky figure, sky god, as a god of vengeance, as a god of power. I think of Jung's book, Answer to Job, which I think is one of the seminal texts of the 20th century. That's coming into question. And I think we have to, what technology is asking us to remember symptomatically is that we need a new God image. I mean, just look at terrorism today and fundamentalism. The three major world religions, Christianity, Islam, and Judaism, they are struggling in their fundamentalist attitude over which God image is right. And I think what we have to, as you imply, what we have to come to is that the God is not external, but we have a God image that we carry within. Jung's notion of the self as containing the God image is very important here. So I do think we need a sense of the sacred and a new sense of the divine and a new sense of the God image.
Okay, good time to take a break. You're listening to Alternative Currents today. I'm Bella Johnson, your host, and speaking today with Robert Romanishin, author of Technology, A Symptom and Dream, and many others. We will be back in just a couple of minutes.
I would have returned your greeting if it weren't for the way you were looking at me. This street is not a market, and I am not a commodity. And don't you find it sad that we can't even say hello? 'Cause you're a man and I'm a woman, and the sun is getting low. And there are some places that I can't go. As a woman I as a person, I don't care. I don't go for the hey baby, what's your name? And I'd like to go alone, thank you, just the same. I am up again against the skin of my guitar in the window of my life, looking out through the bars. I am sounding out the silence, avoiding all the words. I'm afraid I've said too much. I'm afraid of who has hurt me. The story, and it was true for his time, but now the story is different. Maybe I should tell him mine. All the girls line up here, all the boys on the other side. I see your ranks are advancing, I see mine are left behind. I am up again against the skin of my guitar in the window of my life, looking out through the bars. I am sounding out the silence, avoiding all the words. I'm afraid I can never say enough. I'm afraid no one has heard me. And despite all the balls that I've been thrown and forced to drop on the social totem pole, I'm preciously close to the top. They put you in your place and they tell you to behave, but no one can be free till we're all on even grade. And I would have returned your greeting if it weren't for the way you were looking.
And welcome back. This again is Alternative Currents on WERU FM 89.9 Blue Hill and 102.9 Bangor. You are listening today to an interview with Robert Romanishin, author of Technology, A Symptom and Dream, Ways of the Heart, Essays Toward an Imaginal Psychology, and many other works. Welcome back.
Thank you.
So we started touching on the war business, and I'd like to get back into that a little bit because we are clearly living in perilous times, with the nuclear threat always held somewhere close. Your thoughts on the bomb and how this has changed our dreaming, leading to where that leaves us today would be a good thing, I think, to share.
Okay. I'd like to start out by saying that You know, I approach this material. I mean, the title of the book is Technology, a Symptom and Dream, and I cited before how I understand a symptom as a tension of remembering and forgetting. So my stance is not anti-technology. We can't disinvent it, as I said earlier.
Right.
But my stance as a depth psychologist is to see what technology both reveals of the collective human soul and what it conceals, and to engage in the work of remembering what we have forgotten because of what technology conceals about the human condition. So from that point of view, I look at, for example, in this book, the bomb as symptomatically is it an expression? Because at the core of that is the ability to convert matter as mass into energy, the equation of our age equals mc squared. And of course, that discovery, the beginning of the 20th century, which I think ranks as the most important thing in the 20th century, along with depth psychology's recognition of the unconscious, which I think happening simultaneously is something to really ponder, because it brings up the shadow side of our technological mind. That equation was first used destructively to create the bomb, because it sees the fires of the stars in ordinary matter here on Earth, and it loses then the boundary that has always been there between heaven and earth, the celestial and the material world. It erases that boundary, and we adopt a vision here on Earth from as Hannah Arendt quotes in her book The Human Condition, an important book in the 60s. Technology gives us an astrophysical point of view on ourselves and on the material Earth. But suppose we begin to look at that equation, which is first realized as the release of the nuclear fires of destruction, and we begin to read energy as eros, then maybe the bomb becomes a symptomatic way of reminding us that we have lost touch with the powers of eros, which awakens our connection and our bond. Eros is the god of connection. And in the myth Psyche and Eros, Eros, love, is what awakens psyche or soul. So if we can look at that equation as saying not the nuclear fires at the heart of matter, but Eros, then maybe we begin to recover how we cannot live without a sense of our connection to each other, our bodies, nature, the ancestors, the community of the dead, and our relation to the divine. So I don't know if that answers your question. I hope so, but that would be one.
Yeah. It answers it in one way, certainly, and that's that the bomb forces us into that, doesn't it, really?
I mean, it does.
Yeah. Again, the way in which it serves is what I kept looking at while reading this book, is it's like, well, this must be serving humanity in some way, and in this way, we can't not look at this.
That's right, and me, I get very passionate about, as I'm speaking to you now, we're using an instrument of distance, so I can't see you, can't see me, but I can feel your presence here, and I am passionate about, if we don't engage in this work of mourning, in this work of grieving, how we have just taken up technology, it's a crisis of the imagination, and crisis means danger and opportunity. We're realizing only the dangers and not the opportunities. And we have to engage in the work of mourning what we are doing. We have to weep for the trees and the oceans and the animals. And in fact, I think the best line that I wrote in Technology and Symptom and Dream is in a footnote, where I talk about the necessity for grieving what we have done. And along with that grieving and the sense of mourning, we have to engage in the work of being against forgetting. We have to begin to remember, to mourn and to remember.
And it's painful, because I'm one of the people who does that. And it just seems like, you know, sometimes I walk around like an open wound.
Yes.
And it's a tough thing. It would be good to get some feedback on what people are to do with that. And I think that's where you go in your essay, in Ways of the Heart, with the orphan and the angel. Because, boy, when I was done reading that, I was pretty raw.
Just Well, as I say to my students, I'm 63, I've been teaching my whole life, a therapist, a writer, and I say to them, all I ever wanted to be in life was a bus driver.
I know. I remember reading that somewhere. Oh, on your website, I think, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you're driving a heck of a bus is all I got to say, but when you're talking about that pervasive melancholy, you don't know the times lately that I just sit and just meditate. We live in a very blessed place. You know, we're in 60 acres of woods on a lakefront, and you know, I have a lot of time to ponder, a lot of time to reflect, and one of those things that I've been reflecting on lately is very much put forth in your essay about the orphan and the angel, just that sense of, where am I? You know,
yeah.
I'm not here, I'm not there. I actually wrote a poem back in September of 2003 called Chicken Water. And if you can tolerate me reading that, I'd like
sure.
to, because it's the poem of Rilke's that you quoted at the beginning of The Orphan and the Angel is so like this poem that I wrote, having never seen Rilke's poem, that it's eerie. Adrift in a sea of fog, no sign of shore, nor sound of waves lapping, only maddening silence. I cry out for a god, but hear only my own echo, a desperate voice of desire flung on the shoals of a ghost land. The life I have constructed is crumbling. The new has yet to unfold. The whys, hows, and wherefores vanish like mirages. As kids, we called it chicken water, cast upon blistering asphalt, cutting through endless miles of low desert scrub. Sunrise, sunset, nothing changed fast enough for us then. Now here I write from the comfort of my chair, miles from those desert sands, yet and still the road beckons. The caked earth yields to concrete laid down everywhere to accommodate our leave-taking. My dry mouth waters at the approaching oasis, and nearer it appears, and nearer, then vanishes. Sorry. I didn't expect to get triggered that way, but it is so much a metaphor for where I go in those meditations. It just feels like I'm not here, I'm not there. And so when you mentioned the orphan, it really touched me, obviously
yes.
so.
Well, the poem is not only beautiful and a summary. I mean, you're saying everything that has kind of been at the core of the kernel of my work, both with the technology book and what has come after it, and which is about awakening to our condition of exile. This is the other thing that technology allows for us, to realize that as we see the Earth from space, as we begin to understand the shadow side of cutting ourselves off through distance from nature and our bodies and the community of the dead, we awaken to our condition of exile. And there is a grief in that, and a palpable melancholy, and that melancholy and that grief is figured and appears in the archetypal presence of the orphan. And in a sense, if technology allows each of us to get in touch with our orphanic condition, then maybe it begins to awaken in us the necessity for a journey of homecoming. Jung, who did so much work with alchemy, points out how the philosopher's stone was oftentimes called the widow's stone and likened to the orphan. So the orphan is the moment, maybe, when we begin to remember that life here, in this time and space, is part of a cycle of life and death, of cultural history, of the round of ancestors and those who will come after us, and that we belong to a larger tradition. And that's what I think the orphan, at least in my experience, has done for me and what I hear in your poem. I also want to say, in listening to your poem, I know now why I'm a failed poet. Your poem is quite beautiful and quite moving.
Well,
I would love to have a copy of it.
I'll send it to you. I think about two things. One, Jesus saying in the Bible, "You shall be as little, or you must be as little children to enter the kingdom." And Parsifal, real orphan kind of stories both. I think of the child, yes, that's a different archetype, but in the same way, the innocence of that just going back to the center, to the core, to the base, and just saying, where's my home?
Yes. You know,
yeah. And your story about the gorilla in the zoo was just, oh my gosh. I wish you'd tell that story.
Do you want me to tell it now?
I would love it if you would.
Okay. I just want to comment on the possible thing. I have to say, I hope this is not inappropriate, but I went through my own grieving process with the unexpected death of my first wife in 1992, married 25 years, and I never thought that I would come out of that long winter of mourning or even would love again, and I've been fortunate to be able to love twice. Love once in life is a delight, twice is a miracle. And the point that I'm trying to make here is that I have gotten so much of my support and direction for my work from my relationship with my wife, Veronica Goodchild, who's really working on these same issues. And recently we've had conversations about Possible and how important that story is for what we're talking about.
Wow. I also noticed she teaches at Pacifica with you as well.
Yes, in
That's
fact,
fabulous.
One of the other things is we're trying now to put together, we're not sure yet how we can do this or where the location would be, but taking up these issues against forgetting and starting workshops and courses, et cetera, called Dreaming the Future, where we're bringing together, we're trying to bring together people from all disciplines, poets, quantum physicists, mystics, body workers, et cetera, about what is breaking through as the old paradigm breaks down. So that's some of the work that is really kind of happening now. Now, having taken this detour, I forgot your original question.
Oh, that's okay. That's okay. It's a good detour. The gorilla story.
The gorilla story, yeah.
I mean, we're talking about reconnecting with the earth and mourning for the animals, and that story just epitomized so much of the connections that I've had. I just...
Yeah. Well, it took place, oh, maybe 20 years ago. I'm not quite sure of the time now, and it was a winter day in New York, and I was visiting family, and I love to wander the streets, and so I went to the... to the zoo in New York, and there was a lodge. I love all animals. I've been with animals in the wild. As close as we can get to them here in cities is, of course, the zoo, and there's a certain kind of melancholy about that. But I was in the gorilla house, and I was standing in front of this large silverback male, and you know, gorillas are very shy, but their eyes, if you can engage them even for a second, it's like you can fall into pools of time and just swim in their look and their gaze. You can do that with, Rilke says you can do that with any animal. The way the animal looks, you can kind of swim into a bond or a connection. In any case, I'm looking at this gorilla, and he throws a glance at me. He's sitting sideways. I'm looking at him face on. And he turns away, and absentmindedly, I took an orange out of my pocket, and I began tossing it in the air. And the gorilla became interested, and without thinking, and you know, completely oblivious to the sign about not feeding the animals, I threw it to the gorilla, and he caught it. The space separating us was maybe no more than 5 feet, and I... as everyone, I guess, would expect, that he would have taken the orange, retreated to the corner of the cage, and eaten it. But he threw it back to me. And I was astonished. And I threw it to him, he threw it to me, I threw it to him, he threw it to me. We exchanged it maybe 3 times until a zookeeper, the superego of the soul, came in, and he saw what I was doing, and he shouted, "Don't feed the animals." And at that moment, the orange was in mid-flight toward the gorilla. That moment, the bond between us was broken, and he took the orange, kept it, as he should have. And I walked out into the city, into the cold, wintry day, and I felt an incredible connection with this beast, as if he remembered some bond for us, is the way Rilke speaks of the animal too, that they remember for us when we took leave of our instinctual nature, when we broke our connection with nature. And I felt this melancholy too, and I thought it was his melancholy for me. And I felt sad about having left the gorilla inside, and I meant that metaphorically. Both, you know, the gorilla was inside and I was outside, but we had lost touch. We have departed from our basic instinctual ties to the world. So that's the gorilla story.
It's such a good story. A lot of places in your work remind me of Hillman and Rocher's Pan and the Nightmare. You certainly must know that work.
Yes.
Yeah, of how that animal chthonic instinct has been relegated to the nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
But trying to look at the time that we've got and where I want to take this. You mentioned angels in Technology, a Symptom and Dream mm-hmm. as having moved from that great heavenly realm to sitting on a cloud to, you know, slowly the angel shrunk down to our where our head could wrap itself around it, I guess. And then in The Orphan and the Angel, it's almost like a reclamation in a way of that energy within the soul.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah. One of the things about the technology book is that linear perspective opens up the space of explanation. And without going into too much detail what that means here, the space of explanation is a horizontal view of the world that loses its vertical depths. And so what I traced out in the book is the way that the things that belong above life and below it, the sense of spirit, the sense of the sacred, the sense of the celestial, the angelic presences, the invisible beings who do inhabit the world, as poets know, and the sense of the thonic, the earth, the demons, matter, all of that gets eclipsed, because in the space of explanation there is no place anymore for angels or demons, and therefore they must go inside, and they become our own, then, terrible sense of loss for the divine and our sense of nightmares. Because they no longer have a place in the world where we can encounter them. So,
but they're still very much in psyche.
They are in the psyche, yeah. But what we have done under the reign of technology is we've made an artificial barrier between the inside and the outside, right. Split psyche and nature, and we no longer see psyche in the living world.
Right. So your homecoming, in a way, The Orphan and the Angel, I just am trying to move into how you let sadness and grief move you into the angel, the presence of the angel.
Yeah. After my first wife died, and then in the relationship with my second wife, about 8 years after my first wife died, my wife, Veronica, said to me, you know, you've really got to write the stuff that you went through in the grieving process. And so I did, and that became the book, The Soul in Grief. And what I tried to do there, I didn't try to write a manual, a self-help book about grieving. I tried to simply be a witness for what it means to love loss and go into the descent into the underworld. And it's just filled with reveries and stories and descriptions and... And one of those is an encounter over several times with different forms of angelic presences. And it was grief then that opened me up to what lies above and below the space of technological explanation. And as I write in the book, I have no way of proving what I say about the angel, but I can just be a witness for it. And if people have had the experience, then they can say, yes, it feels something like that, because what I wrote is that the angel is either the aftertaste or the foretaste of our human existence, or maybe both. But it's based on actual encounters with angelic presences, some of whom are quite dark, by the way.
Mm.
So it's not the Christian angel so much as it is this this being that belongs to the invisible realms.
Right. And if I can quote you, and then we need to close out from The Orphan and the Angel, from Ways of the Heart. We have forfeited our birthright in the scheme of creation, and as such, we have lost any right, if we ever really had one, to save the world. Only the world can save us. We need this humility. We need to learn again how to pray.
Did I write that?
You did.
Well, I'm glad I did.
Me too. Well, I honor your place in the world, and thank you so much for being with us. Any closing remarks that you'd like? We have about a minute.
Well, I just want to thank you for the opportunity to really speak about what matters to me, what I've devoted my teaching and writing and life as a therapist to. And I just feel like, you know, I wanted to be a bus driver. I would love to retire, but, you know, life is what pulls us into it, and it's not what we plan to do. And so this was a splendid opportunity for me, and I'm very grateful.
As I am for you. Thank you. Robert Romanishin, name spelled Romanishyn. You can read about his works on his website, www.online.pacifica.edu/Romanishin. I again would invite you to email me if you have any questions about this or any other program or how to get in touch with the work of various guests that you've heard on Alternative Currents. My website, bellajohnson.com, BellaJohnson.com. Again, thank you for listening to Alternative Currents. I look forward to speaking to you again next month. Take care.
My soul has been torn from me, and my heart, it has been rent, and I am crying. All beauty around me fades, and I am screaming. I am the last of the great whales, and I am dying. Last night I heard the cry of my last companion. The harpoon gun, and I was alone. I reflect on the days gone by when we were thousands, and I know that I soon shall die, the last Leviathan. This morning the sun arose, crimson in the sky. Ice was the color of blood, and the wind, it did sigh. I rose up to take a breath. It was my last one. From the burn. I am done. Now that we're all gone, and there's no more hunting, the big fellow is no more, and there's no use lamenting. Which race will be next in line? Hope for the slaughter. The elephant or the seal, or your sons and daughters.